account, please give me an account. Just tell me what login name you want, and then I'll create an account for you. Also, this can be useful because unlike your Xeno account, say Modular has a large hard drive. So it has a terabyte hard drive connected to it, and no quotas or anything. So if you get annoyed by only having 400 megabytes or whatever, you could use Modular instead. But don't count on regular backups or anything like that.
I can't do that. What's the VMX? VMX.VMX. Supposed to click that to install Sage.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, if you want to install Sage in Windows, what?
I can't run that.
So you need to install VMware Player.
Oh, okay.
It's a free program. So he's just asking, if you have Windows, there's a simple way to install VMware, which is you download this 350 megabyte zip file, you extract it, and what you get is a Sage virtual machine. And to run it, to use the virtual machine, you have to use VMware. VMware is completely free. Not free in the sense I met yesterday, I mean Monday, but free in the sense of beer, as they say. So you can download this thing called VMware Player and then run the virtual machine. And that's a sort of, you know, very quick, total of 10 clicks way to install Sage on Windows. And it's the most efficient way also as far as the resulting program that you get. But you should install VMware Player. VMware Player itself takes a long time to install for some reason, but I don't know why. And then I have a bunch of questions about your experience reading through the tutorial. So that's the homework for this week. All right, so today's lecture is about HECA operators. I'm not going to do everything in the handout, but I'll do something to get you a good flavor of what's going on. And I'll also talk about work of Ian Snowden and the conjecture of Maeda. But let me just give you a quick sense for the structure of what I'll do today. So I've defined for you in this class so far various spaces of modular forms. For example, recently we've been thinking a lot about MKSL2Z, which is the space of modular forms of level 1 and 3K. And inside of there you have a subspace SK. And you now know how to write down the basis for the space. You know how to, you know, explicitly in terms of queue expansions. But you might be wondering what, and you know, there must be more to the story. What can you do with these spaces besides write down bases of them? Since that's really not that much. Well, the really interesting stuff happens when you consider the action of the ring T, which is generated by certain things called HECA operators, which are indexed by the positive integers T1, T2, T3, and so on. And this ring T acts on MK, and it also acts on SK. So MK then becomes a module over this ring. This is a commutative ring. And it's actually finite as a module over Z. So essentially, you can think of it as being kind of like an order in a product of number fields. But in fact, it's not in general such a thing. Well, it is at level 1, but in general, it cannot be like that. Actually, is it level 1 a product of an order in, I mean, an order in a product of number fields? But it's a commutative ring. It's called the HECA algebra. And it's where all the action is. This is by far the most central object in this class. So now I'm going to tell you about it on level 1 today. There's a definition of the HECA algebra acting on MK gamma, where gamma is any congruence, well, say gamma is a group that contains gamma 1 of n. So you have a higher level notion of HECA algebra and HECA operators. But I won't go into that today. I'll just talk about level 1. Okay, so that's what today's about. I'm going to tell you what these are. I'm going to give two ways of thinking about them and tell you about some of their basic properties. The notes contain pretty much very complete proofs of the basic properties of HECA operators on level 1 in a lot of detail. And I'll only give kind of a sketch in a couple of cases of those proofs. So here's the definition. So for any positive integer n, define a set S of n as follows. It's a set of
matrices, 2x2 matrices, AP0D with, and they're, just to emphasize, they're 2x2 integer matrices, and they satisfy A greater than or equal to 1, AD equal to N, and 0 less than or equal to B less than D. So for a specific value of N, you could quickly enumerate all such matrices. For example, let's try S of 1. So our condition is that these are integers. A is greater than or equal to 1. And the product of A and D is equal to 1. And so that gives us pretty little choice. So that tells us that this A has to be equal to 1, and D has to be 1, since the product of A and D is 1. That's always 0. And B can be either 0 or, it has to be strictly less than D, but D is 1, so that's the only matrix. Okay, let's try another one, S2. So we have to list these. So I'll start with A equal to 1 and list all of them. So A is 1, and A times D is 2, so D has to be 2. Lower left entry is 0. The right upper right entry gets to be between 0 and, but 0 and 1 inclusive, so it could be 0, or it could be 1. Okay, so these are the possibilities for A equal to 1. Now, what are the possibilities for A equal to 2? Well, the product of A and D is equal to 2, so D is equal to 1. And then again, you have this. Now, there's only one choice for B that's between 0 and 1 like that, and that's B equals 0. So for S2, there are these three matrices. And in general, for SP, there are, I think, P plus 1 of these matrices. So here's a definition of the F operator. F are, I'll just write it in standard way, Tn K of F. So here, just to emphasize, I'm using a slightly different notation over here, but okay. So here F should be a weakly modular function of weight K. And then I'm just going to give you a way of taking F and giving back another function on the upper half plane. And here's what you do. You just sum over the elements gamma in S sub n, F bar gamma k. Now, I should remind you, I actually happen to find F bar gamma k when gamma isn't an element of SL2z. So just let me put up in a bar here what I mean by F bar gamma k. For any element gamma in M2z. And F bar gamma k is equal to the determinant of gamma to be k minus 1 cz plus d 2 minus k F of gamma z. So this is just a generalization of the previous definition. If gamma is actually an SL2z, then this determinant is equal to 1, and you just get what I defined before. Okay? So that right there is the definition of the Heck operator T sub n on weight k modular forms. You simply sum over these. Now, there's a couple of questions that are very natural to ask at this point. First, what in the heck is this set S of n? It looks completely contrived. Second, does this really send modular forms to modular forms? It's not at all a priori obvious, to me at least, that if I take this sum, I'm going to get a weakly modular function, even if F is a weakly modular function. Why should the invariance under SL2z be preserved? First, just so you can think about S of n, here's a way to view these matrices. So everybody here knows about reduced row echelon form of a matrix, like from your linear algebra class. Well, there's an analog of that for matrices over the integers called Hermite normal form. It's exactly the analog. The difference is that you're only allowed, with Gauss form, you multiply by these elementary matrices, which basically, on the left, which basically amounts to multiplying by invertible matrices over whatever field you're working with. Over the integers, you only multiply by invertible matrices of the integers, and that restricts what you can do. For example, if you take this matrix, its echelon form is the identity, but over the rational numbers, but over the integers, the analog of the echelon form is just this matrix again, because there's no way you're going to multiply it on the left by an invertible matrix over the integers and somehow get rid of the 2 and the 4. Okay? And this analog of echelon form, but over the integers, is called Hermite normal form.
Hermite normal form just equals echelon over Z.
And these are exactly the collection of Hermite forms of matrices corresponding to, well, basically the matrices of determinant n in M2 of Z. Another way to think about this is the following. Think about all the lattices inside of Z cross Z. So lattices L inside of Z cross Z, where the index of the lattice is n. For each lattice, you could choose a basis, then put that basis in Hermite normal form to get a canonical basis. And this is exactly, if you take the two rows of that basis, or if you take the two basis vectors in Hermite normal form and stick them in the matrix, these are exactly the matrices you would get. So the set S of n is really just the same thing as the collection of lattices of index n in Z cross Z, or in Z direction Z, or in Z to the 2. And that's why, for example, we saw that there were three of them, and in the case of 2, that's lattices of index 2 inside of Z cross D. These are the same, these are sort of like lines inside of Z mod 2Z cross Z mod 2Z. There are three of them. Okay, so that's a way of thinking about S of n. So a Heck operator, TNK, really you're summing over, doing something that involves each of the lattices of index n inside of Z cross D. So what's so special about these Heck operators? So they preserve weakly modular functions. More precisely, if you have a weight k weakly modular function and a Heck operator T sub nk, then Tnk of f is, again, a weakly modular function of weight k. I will prove that in detail in just a minute. What other properties do they have? Another important one is that they preserve holomorphicity. That's actually not too hard to see. If you have a function that's holomorphic on the upper half plane, and then you take each of these are all holomorphic because, here you're not doing very much. You're just multiplying it's like a composition of a holomorphic function with another holomorphic function, another, just a constant here. This is just a finite sum of clearly holomorphic functions. So if f is holomorphic, then tnkf is also holomorphic. So preserve holomorphicity. They preserve on an H and also an H star. There's also some really amazing relations that the Heck operator satisfy. Namely, TNK composed with TMK is equal to TNMK as long as the GCD of N and M is equal to 1. This says something about summing over the action of all the lattices of index n and lattices of index m being the same as summing over the action of lattices of index n m. And indeed, the way you prove this, which is given in detail in the notes, is you understand how lattices of index n m decompose as a lattice of index m followed by a lattice of index n, where when n and m are coprime. And it's not true if n and m aren't coprime. So, this is one of the most important properties of the Heck operator. So they're multiplicative as a function of the subscript. And one other property is really all you need to know. And
Well, try to squeeze it in. You can put it here. So the last property is just an analog of this, but when n and m are not coprime. More specifically, t sub p to the r k is t sub p to the r minus 1 k times t sub p k minus p to the k minus 1 times t sub p to the k minus 2 k. I remember that correctly.
Yeah. So this tells you if you have a Heck operator T sub the power of a prime, this is where P prime, and R any positive integer, it tells you how to write it in terms of Heck operators T sub P with to smaller powers of the P. In other words, this allows you to write T sub P to the anything as a polynomial in T sub P. So.
Should that be R P to the R minus 1 or is
Q? Yes, it should be P to the R minus 1 things. Yeah, at the very end. So I thought I wrote that for that's the correction you meant on the very right. Yes, thank you. Okay, so these are the basic properties, and the one that I'll explain why the Heck operators preserve modular forms at all, and I'll say something about, say, that one right there. Actually, there's one other important property, which is that if you apply TP to a Q expansion, so given a modular function, it has a Q expansion. So the sum over n and z, a sub n, q to the n. If you apply TP to that, here's what you get on the level of Q expansions. It's really quite simple. The sum over m and z of a m p plus p to the k minus 1 a m divided by p q to the n. And here, if m over p is not an integer, then a m over p is 0. If m over p, well, I mean, I guess I'll just leave it like that because I suppose it's possible that, well, okay, I'll just say that. So if a m over p equals 0, if p does not divide m. So see, that's a formula for the Heck operators directly on Q expansions, which is really important if you ever want to compute them, because this definition, though it's actually pretty nice for proving some of these relations here, it's not so good for computation, since after all, the way that we know how to describe MK is by giving an explicit basis of Q expansions. And if you have the explicit basis of Q expansions, this is a nice way to compute the Heck operators, because all it requires is the Q expansions. It just completely explicitly takes one Q expansion and gives you back another one. On the other hand, if you imagine trying to prove multiplicativity like this, or this other relation, directly on the Q expansions, it's extremely confusing. It's not at all clear how to do that. So there are two sort of different ways of looking at the Heck operators, this or that. You could define them in either way, but this is the better definition, though, because it's easier to prove things from this point of view, and it's easier to derive that from this than the other way around.
Are we really preserving holomorphicity on H star?
If something's holomorphic on all of H star, then its image under Heck operator will also be holomorphic on all of H star.
Okay, we don't introduce a pole at that rational point, negative D over C.
Do you think we do based on the Q expansion?
I've been looking at the F gamma one line above that where you have everything.
Here.
Yeah.
C is always zero.
C is zero and D is
positive. Yeah, C is always zero. Good point. Okay, but C is in fact zero for all the matrices.
Okay.
So actually, yeah, this is just D to the minus K. Okay. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, any other comments? So
I mean, from the point of view of telling you facts, this is essentially everything I wanted to tell you today. This, and that. Plus, I wanted to do an example in which we actually compute one of these. But from the point of view of proving things, I haven't proved anything. I've just introduced some really weird, mysterious stuff. And it really only is going to reduce its level of mystery, I think, if you see some arguments that involve these objects. So right now I'm going to prove that if you apply the Heck operator TNK to a weakly modular function, the thing you get out is a weakly modular function again. And I'll save the definition of the Heck operators right here. So what we have is a specific F, and what you want to prove is that for any choice of gamma in SL2Z, that here's what we want, that this, wait, what am I doing? If you take TNKF and hit it by gamma K, we want, see that that's the same thing as TNKF. Right? That's what it means to be a weakly modular function. It just means you have a meromorphic function that is preserved under the bar K action of every element of SL2Z. And the property of staying weakly modular is just pretty easy to see from the definition. The property of staying meromorphic is pretty clear from the definition. You're just adding on the finite sum of meromorphic functions. So let's see if we can show this. Okay, so here's what we do. Take the set S sub n, and just as it's defined there, and imagine multiplying it by gamma. By that I mean take each of the matrices in this set and multiply them on the right by our fixed element gamma. Let's just think about what we get. We'll get another set of the same number of matrices, and the resulting matrices, they're what you get by taking and applying an element of SL2Z on the right. So, you'll end up getting a whole bunch of other matrices. What's the determinant of the product? What are the determinants of the elements of SN gamma? N. You get a whole bunch of 2x2 integer matrices of determinant N. And you get a sort of a bi, you get a, that's in bijection with the original set S of N. Each of these matrices of determinant N correspond again to a lattice of index N inside of a Z cross Z. Because, I mean, there are a bunch of matrices. Any matrix, any 2x2 integer matrix of determinant N corresponds to a lattice of index N inside of SL2Z. If you just take the row generated by the product, take the lattice generated by the rows of the product matrix, and you'll get another lattice of index N. So the rows of this, rows generate a subgroup or lattice of Z cross Z of index N. By the way, quick commercial break about lattices. Lobosch, who's came up with the great algorithm for lattices, is speaking at 4 o'clock. So everybody should go to his talk at 4 o'clock today. Okay, so the rows generate a subgroup of index n, and you could apply the Hermite normal form algorithm to the resulting product matrix. And doing that, you just take one of these. I'll call it sigma. So for each, say this thing's delta, this is gamma, and for each of these deltas, there's a sigma sub delta that's in SL2Z, and it transforms this product delta gamma back into Hermite normal form. This Hermite normal form operation, it's just like reduced to echelon form. You're multiplying on the left by an invertible matrix to get it into that form. You compose together all the operations that you do. The product of those gives you a invertible matrix that transforms your product into Hermite normal form. So this product, sigma delta delta gamma, this is in Hermite normal form. Therefore, it's just an SN again. So sigma delta times gamma, this is in S of n again. So for each delta, you can find a sigma sub delta, so that this whole thing is in S of n. All right, so now let's prove this. So take, consider T, N, K of F. I noticed that the proof that I wrote in the notes, I didn't index the various sigmas, and it doesn't make any difference, and the proof works perfectly if you do, but in the notes I didn't do that, and I'll do that on the board. So let's just, so what is the definition of T, N, K, F? Well, it's right there. You sum over the elements of S of N and apply each of them to F. However, instead of taking the deltas in S of n, let's just instead take the sigma delta delta gammas in S of n. We run through the elements of S of n again. So all I did was I took my original S of n, I multiply all the elements on the right by gamma, I got a totally different set of matrices of determinant n, I take all the elements of that new set, and I put them in Hermite normal form, and I get back just the set S of n again. But the elements of this new set are written in the form sigma, delta, gamma. So instead of summing over the S of n's, I sum over things sigma sub delta times gamma. And that's what I put here. But I'm running over exactly the same elements as I would originally in the definition of T, N, K acting on F. Okay? Is that step clear to people?
How do you know that reduction to the Hermite normal form is injective on this set?
Okay, that's a good question. if I can think of a way to answer your question. So there's really two steps. First, multiplication by gamma. And that's clearly injective because gamma is invertible. Just multiplying. So that's injective. So the next question is why, if you take all of those and reduce them to Hermite normal form, is what you get back the same collection of lattices you started with? So let's see if I can explain that. So if you had two that had the same, so first an observation, if you have two things that have the same Hermite normal form and then the same lattice. So if there were two in the set of matrices sigma gamma delta gamma that came from the same delta gamma, then if there were two different delta gammas that give you the same sigma gamma delta gamma, then these two delta gammas would correspond to exactly the same lattice inside of Z cross E. Maybe not given by the same matrix, certainly not given by the same matrix, but they correspond to the same lattice. But what you've done is you've just taken all of your lattices of index n, multiplying by gamma is just taking that entire collection, changing basis uniformly. So you can't tell that any of the lattices are the same. Is that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
So
maybe this is a little bit off, but the idea is that the sentence starts in the normal form.
Yes.
Right? So if you were to multiply by the invertible matrix and produce that, mm-hmm. and you got two things of the same value, the same SN is already in that form.
I'm not sure I'm convinced by that exactly, but if it convinces you, I'm very happy to hear that. I don't quite. It's just that, I mean, just think about this. So you're taking all the lattices of index n, you're applying this one matrix to them, which is like changing, uniformly changing the basis that you're considering by an invertible, you know, linear transformation z cross z. You get a whole bunch of lattices of index n in the new thing. In fact, all of the lattices of index n in the new thing. You take all of those and put them in Hermite normal form, and you have to get just as many, you know, Hermite normal forms as what you started with. And therefore, it's a bijunction. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so you have this, and now it's just an easy calculation to see what we want. So you take this and use the fact that this is an action, which was one of the homework problems. So you're summing over sigma delta delta gamma f bar sigma sub gamma. Okay. Bar delta k bar gamma k. All right, the first one, that just is equal to f, because after all, sigma is in SL2z, and f is a weakly modular function, so it's invariant under the action of SL2z. So you can just rewrite this as sum f bar delta k bar gamma k. Or you're summing over the same thing. And now f bar delta k, here, let's just rewrite, since we're always borrowing by gamma, and we're summing over all the possibilities for delta in s sub n at this point, we might as well just write this as sum over delta in sn, f bar delta k, and then the whole thing bar gamma. So I guess I'm using here that the bar k action is just distributes cross addition, which is pretty clear from the definition. But this is just Tn applied to f. And then you take your result and you hit it by gamma k. So now let's just look at both sides of this long equality. On the one hand, we have Tn of f hit by gamma. On the other hand, we just have Tn of f. Therefore, Tn of f is fixed under the action of SL2z. So it's a weakly modular function again. Okay, any questions? The proofs of 3 and 4 are very similar in that you think about how you're summing over various lattices of given indices, and the arguments really have a very similar flavor to this, so I'm not going to give them. No, I suggested giving 3, but there's no way I'll have it there. But again, we're in notes. And 4 is, let's see, 5 is pretty straightforward to follow. It uses some like basic property about, I guess, sums of roots of unity. You can see the proof in Sarah's book. And if you're having trouble getting chapter 7 of Sarah's book, I put a link to it on the course website, or at least I will as soon as I get to update the website from my laptop, which will happen in an hour or two. So you can easily download that. Okay, so these are the basic properties of Hecke operators on level 1 modular forms. Just an advertisement for studying modular forms further. If you consider, if you learn about modular curves, then you can view all of these Hecke operators as being induced by correspondences on modular curves. Correspondences are sort of a standard thing that algebraic geometers consider that induce maps on divisors and sheaves and so on. So you get a far more complicated way of proving very similar things, but it's much more, makes more sense in some way, at least geometrically. So there's an alternative way of thinking about a lot of this. But you can see that these properties, they're not completely trivial, and really some work goes into proving each of them. Now, just to give you a sense that there's something here. Okay, another property that I sort of sketched was that the cusp forms are preserved.
And I'll show you a neat application of that right now. So we now have the Hecke algebra. That's the ring generated by all of the Hecke operators, T1, T2, and so on. I'll frequently omit the K. When I write Tn acting on a form, that form has a specific weight, so the K is implicit in the notation. Anyways, you have this ring, and it's commutative because of 3 and 4, and it also preserves the decomposition Mk as a direct sum of Sk and the subspace generated by, say, Gk. You guys in sine series Gk. Now, here's an interesting application of this fact. Let's take k equal to 12. When k equals 12, Mk has dimension 2. And in particular, Mk is equal to the C-span of delta and the weight 12 Eisenstein series G12. And the fact that the Hecke operators preserve each of these means that delta is sent to a scalar multiple of delta by the Hecke operators. So for each n, Tn of delta is equal to some scalar times delta, since S12 is just spanned by delta, and the Hecke operators preserve Sk. Now, if we instead think of the Hecke operators from the point of view of Q expansions, then you can figure out what the star is, since, well, in terms of the Q expansion of delta. So watch this. And you don't have to do too much work to do this. So delta is, it has some Q expansion, where I'll just call it coefficients tau of n. And by the way, this function that associates to n, the nth coefficient of delta is called the Ramanujan tau function. And now if you apply the Hecke operator, say tp, for p prime to delta, you can just use this formula. There won't be any negative terms in the series. So let's just figure out what the coefficient of q to the 0 is. So to use this formula, you take a specific value of m, say 0, and then you figure out what the coefficient of that power of q is. So let's do m equals 0 first. So for delta, for m equal to 0, we'll have something here. And then we'll have something for m equals 1, and so on. So let's figure out what it is for 0. For 0, it's a sub 0 plus some power of p times a sub 0 again. Which is 0 because a sub 0 is itself 0. That's a 0. And then for q to the 1, we have a sub 2, p equals 2. So a sub 2 plus, but a sub 2 is just, the a's are just the coefficients, so it's actually tau of 2. So it's tau of, I'm saying 2, but I mean p, sorry, tau of p plus p to the power of k minus 1, whatever that is, times a sub 1 over p. But a sub 1 over p, that's the 1 over p coefficient of delta, which is just 0. So we don't have to worry about this term. So plus 0. So the coefficient of q, so here the coefficient of q is 1. Here the coefficient of q is tau of p. So you can tell what the star is here. It's just tau of, in general, tau of n. There's a similar formula for p replaced by a similar, more complicated formula when p is composite. And it turns out that this is just tau of n. So So just by figuring out the coefficient of Q, you know what all the coefficients are for all higher powers of Q, because you know that delta has to be sent to another cusp form, and the whole space of cusp forms, by all this valence formula stuff from before, has dimension 1 in this particular case. So delta has to be sent to a scalar multiple of delta, which has to be tau p, because we work out the scalar multiple just by finding the coefficient of q in tp of delta. Okay? So you have that. Now, here's a neat application. We haven't really given you anything yet. But let's take two distinct integers, n and m, that are coprime. Then tn, tm of delta, on the one hand, this is tn of tm of delta, which is tn of tau of m, which is just a scalar, times delta, which is equal to tau of m times delta. On the other hand, because of this relation between Heck operators, which is proved by some very tedious Clayton-Rowland lattices of index n, m, and nm, this is equal to t sub nm of delta. But that's equal to tau of nm times delta. So these two things are equal. Tau of nm delta is equal to tau of m delta. And what does that tell you about the function tau? It's a multiplicative function of an integer. It's an integer value function of integers, and it's multiplicative. And you know that because of properties of Heck operators. And I don't think it's obvious at all from the definition, say, of tau as the coefficients of q product 1 minus q to the n to the 24, that the function that gives the coefficients is multiplicative. But in fact, we just proved that.
Rather, these are contextual data.
Yeah. And didn't know how to prove it. So we just proved something Romanogen didn't know how to prove. So it can't be completely obvious in elementary based on the product. Also, Romanogen conjectured a bound on the size of tau of p. And there's a way to take something that's an eigenvector for all the Heck operators. Delta is an eigenvector for all the Heck operators. Eigenvector meaning it's rescaled by the Heck operators. And anytime you have an eigenvector for the Heck operators, there's an association due to Serre and Deligne of a Galois representation. And there is there's a proof of the Riemann hypothesis for curves over finite fields due to Deligne that, suitably interpreted in an extended, gives also a way to bound the bound the coefficients of any eigenvector of the Heck operators. You can also prove Romanogen's conjecture bound on the sizes of these taus by using this work of Deligne and Serre that bounds coefficients of eigenvectors, basically bounds eigenvalues of Heck operators. So there's that. Okay. So any questions? So I told you most of what I wanted to tell you. Now, what should I choose for my last 30 seconds? So if you want to compute a specific Hecke operator on a space, this gives you a little sense of how you would do that. You write down the basis for the space of modular forms in terms of Q expansions, and you know how to do that from last Friday. And then you apply the Hecke operators to each of the basis, and then you get from that via standard linear algebra a matrix. And there's a very systematic way in terms of the Victor Miller basis to do that, explained in the notes here on page 31. And in the case of weight 12, I've worked out in complete and utter detail all the steps of doing this for weight 12. Okay, so I encourage you to look through that and to look at what you get.
Next time I'll say a little about Maeda's conjecture and Edixhoven's work, and then I'll talk about the early numbers.